Okay, so welcome. Let's just check on the volume. Is that good? Can anybody not hear? Thumbs up. Okay, good. So tonight I'd like to explore this topic of false premises. So these are underlying assumptions of how we take the world, how we take ourselves, that really tie us into our suffering, tie us into our struggle with life. And by questioning these and understanding, investigating these assumptions, things change in a very profound way for us. So this last year I've been doing interviews on both on retreats and in day-longs. And often students come with a sincerity. They have an issue they're trying to solve, perhaps in their daily life, or trying to work with an issue in their meditation, with their minds. So there's a lot of tenderness of their heart. They're really bringing things forward. And there may be a lot of content about the story or the details which they're struggling with. And sometimes, as I listen to them, I can hear underneath the story, underneath the superficial things that need to be fixed, underneath that, and see this underlying premise that everything's resting upon, this sense of this underlying assumption, just like if you remember back to your mathematical days or your logic days, that there's this underlying premise that the whole argument is based on. And this premise is often accepted as completely true, that there's this validity that we put into that. And their whole struggle, their whole suffering is based on this one premise, which often is not true, is often something that they've taken as being true, that's an assumption that they've taken on. So it can take the shape as a defining self-belief. I'm this kind of a person, I'm not very successful, I'm lonely, no one loves me. These deep self-beliefs, it can be a pattern of struggle, that I always have to do something with my experience, I have to fight with it, I have to overcome it. It can be patterns of separation, of isolation. So these underlying qualities have a certain logic to them. There's a natural course of action based on that logic. So when I say logic, it's not necessarily like an intellectual knowledge or intellectual sense, thinking around it, because these assumptions are often very deep in our subconscious. They're not fully seen. But based on these deep patterns, we build this whole logic around them. How should I act? Often has a very emotional quality, has an instinctual quality that we drive from. And it really defines what's possible and what's impossible in our lives. So it's this filter that we see life through. And essentially, it shapes our reality. And if it's not seen, it has such a strong power over how we are in the world, how we act in the world. But when it's seen, when someone sees it just as this premise, just as this assumption that they've taken for to be true, and they realize that maybe it isn't true, or even see clearly that it's not true, then suddenly their whole argument starts to fall away. Everything that they based upon, this grounding starts to shift, and then the problem is seen in a very different way, in a much bigger context than they may have realized. And then the deeper issue starts to become clearly seen. And so instead of the practice about this situation in my life, it's really about how am I relating? How am I taking shape? How am I showing up and forming myself in relationship to this issue? Now sometimes, for myself and for yogis, they're not ready to see these deeper qualities. It could be that the content has such a drive to it, like perhaps a recent loss of a loved one, some trauma, some abuse. So there's a lot of content that they're working very much, and it's helpful and healthy to work on this level of content till that gets to be resolved. And then sometimes we're a little stubborn. You want to hold on to these beliefs. So we have to play them out, play out the strategies based on these assumptions till we see that they don't work. We have to follow through. And we have to hit bottom to see that and see that for ourselves, to really take that in deeply to our own being. But then other times, there's a certain ripeness that comes forth in a student. There's this ripeness to look at life differently, to have this different relationship to my experience. Perhaps you've struggled, we've struggled with a pattern for so long that we've tried again and again and just see it's not working. We've tried every solution. And then for whatever reason, suddenly we see things more clearly. You know, perhaps hearing a Dharma talk, hearing an interview, doing, you know, just even seeing nature, suddenly there's this shift that happens. So let's just step back for a moment and look at a strongly held belief that we now know is false. Okay, this earth is the center of the universe. All right. So this is the accepted truth, you know, for almost 20 centuries. You know, before in BC, the Greeks formed this way of explaining how the heavens work in relationship to the earth. It was based on observation. It was based on, you know, a set of assumptions. And so it was the accepted belief. It was widely held until 1600s. And you can look at the sky and you can make those observations fit into this theory. You know, if you look at the Bible, there's biblical references that support that, that further entrench that belief. Even today, we talk about the sunrise and sunset. There's still this sense of the earth, sun is going around us, that we're the center of the universe. So in this belief and other scientific beliefs, how do we finally realize that they're not true? How do we understand that deep underlying premise is not correct? So in the case of the earth and the sun and the universe, Copernicus developed another theory that the earth is actually revolving around the sun. Okay, we all know this is true, but that was a bit radical back then. And he did it at the end of his life, and not much came of it until Galileo used his telescope and established some proof around it. Okay, you can see how these planets move. So some of the observing the facts, observing nature, allowed him to understand that the Earth isn't the center of the universe. But that wasn't received very well. You know, it was really rejected in his time, and it wasn't accepted till many years later when other voices came in and said, yeah, this theory is correct. So how do we realize our own center is not the center of the universe? How do we realize these underlying facts aren't true? So we need a certain ability to look clearly, to go beneath the surface of our normal mind states, our normal assumptions of how things are. Through investigation and mindfulness. So this practice we do here, we just practice for 40 minutes, is called insight meditation, also called vipassana. So it can be translated as seeing clearly and understanding what's seeing, to understand how things really are. So meditation is often, I frame it as, it's just this tool to look to see clearly how our experience is really below our theories, our ideas. And in that seeing, we start to see life very differently, like Galileo looking up and seeing the heavens through his telescope, and seeing the moons of Jupiter, and realizing that doesn't make sense, this theory. And through this seeing clearly, our struggle starts to fall away. The ways that we struggle is what we primarily see through this meditation practice. So I'd like to explore tonight three underlying premises that I see in students' practices, I see in my own practice, and how we've taken as being true, which perhaps aren't. So the first one is that thoughts are true. That everything that we think has a validity to it, has a authority to it. If we can take it on it's something that we really should believe, that we should place our trust on. So this is not about thoughts being bad, it's about our investment in truth in them, our investment in the absolute nature of our thought, that this is really the reality of things. So some thoughts are more accurate than others, you know, and some are completely wrong, or trying to be completely wrong. So we talked about the earth being the center of the universe. But back then it made sense based on the belief structure, based on the observations. You know, another one is, if we think about what's the most important organ, internal organ in our bodies that defines who we are. You know, we say the brain. The brain is the sense of consciousness. But the ancient Egyptians didn't feel that way. When they mummified people, they threw the brain away. and they put all these other organs in, you know, the heart and the intestines. That's where the center of the being was felt to be from the ancient Egyptians. So other thoughts have a certain usefulness in our life, an accuracy that allows us to navigate the world, able us to do our jobs, to work, to succeed, to relate to others, help us remember what we need to do. Without thought, our lives would look very different if there wasn't a sense of being able to plan and develop theories. So the point is really to hold thought lightly, to hold it not as this firm thing. In medical school, they used to teach the students on the first day, they would say, okay, half of what we're going to teach you is wrong. You just don't know which half. You know, so there's this questioning that, you know, not to take even science, even something as concrete as medicine, as being solid, as being absolute. So as we have thoughts, as thoughts arise, we can reflect, is this thought accurate? You know, does it seem like it's based on anything? And is it helpful? But even if it does seem accurate, to realize it's not an absolute truth. So the problem happens when we start to take thoughts as being absolutely true, as being this is the reality. Because thoughts don't have an absolute reference point. You know, everyone doesn't think the same thing, do we? It's really filtered through our past, our history, our memories, our experiences, our culture, our language. And so different people experience things in different way, even the same exact experience. There's an interesting example. Used to be the Talus Bridge, maybe it still is, in the south of France. So when they built it, the Germans described it as floating above the clouds with elegance and lightness and breathtaking beauty. So that's the way they described it. While the French described it as immense and a concrete giant. Okay, so this is the same exact structure. But why is there such a big difference in how it was described? If you look at the language, in German, the word for bridge is feminine, while with French, the word for bridge is masculine. So there's this assumption, this is a feminine bridge, this is a masculine bridge, and it shapes how we think about it, how we act from it. And so this happens with us all the time in our culture. We have this assumption of how we should be based on our gender, on our race, on our religion, and how other people are or should be or should not be. It becomes this filter that we don't even realize that we're placing upon the world. So it's this unconscious quality of thought that if we hold it as being really solid, as being the absolute truth, we come across another person who has a different view, then we have conflict, we have struggle. So how do thoughts arise? In the last year, Rodney went through the dependent origination, the cycle of dependent origination. And those early cycles, those early pieces of that cycle contribute to how we interpret senses. So something as simple as a bell ringing. You know, we hear it, we identify it. There's perhaps memory about the bell. At the end of a meditation, there's perhaps relief that, okay, I get to stretch my legs. I can come off this horrible thing called meditation. But it's really filtered through our own experience, through what we know it to be. And so meditation allows us to start to see the difference between our thoughts and ideas around something versus the direct experience. And what's one of the first things that people start to realize is that there's this veneer over my life called thought. Everything I see, I label it, I say this is what it is, I identify it, I know it to be this. In meditation, we start to go underneath that, just through the simple practice of coming back to your breath, coming back to the body sensations. We keep releasing the ideas of those concepts, those ideas of those experience, and come back to this actual direct reality of it, the direct touching of it. And this is one of the most valuable things of meditation, is we start to have this different way of relating to life that's much more immediate and more direct. At the same time, we start to hold our thoughts more lightly, our concepts more lightly. The tighter we hold our concepts, the more suffering we have, the more conflict we have. So when we take our interpretations through, you know, through hearing, through memory, through experience as being absolute, again, that's where the struggle happens. You know, there's countless times when I've had an argument with my wife that, you know, she did something and I get upset about it, and then I do something and she gets upset, and there's a cycle of arguing back and forth until we finally start to listen to each other. Okay, what did you really say? What did you really mean? And realize there's this misconception of what was said. This whole argument was based on this falsity. Look at prejudice. You know, how we take people who are different from us, from race, from sexual orientation, from gender, education, socioeconomic. Any way we define as someone as other, there's this whole way we hold them in a certain, really a prison of concept, of idea. And so much suffering comes from that. And then there's another example that's pretty striking of how we take thoughts as being true. You know, taking our senses and interpreting them as a thought and saying this is true. So this happened apparently in the 30s, that this physician in another country decided to do an experiment. So he went to a prison where a young man was on death row. Okay, and he convinced him to say, okay, you're going to get, you know, put to death in a few months, but how about we put you to death this way instead? We're going to bleed you to death. Okay, so it's not going to be painful. It's going to be, you know, gradual and easy, and be a better deal than this other one. So he's going to do this psychological experiment on this young man. So he strapped him down, you know, blindfolded him, and put these different buckets of water on each of the four limbs. And so then they scratched each of his limbs, not enough to break the skin, but just to give that sensation. And then the water was dripping into each bucket, you know, slowly, fast, and then getting quieter, slower and slower. And at the same time, the physician was being quieter with his voice, having less and less, you know, becoming more quiet as he spoke. So you can imagine that scenario. You're sitting there, you're laying down, and you're just hearing this drip, drip, drip. But he heard that drip, and he interpreted it as the blood leaving his body, as his life leaking away. At the end of the experiment, even though this was a completely healthy young man, he appeared to have fainted, but when they looked closer, he had actually died. He had scared himself to death. So this is a really striking example of how we take thought as being true and how much control it has over us. And now we take that same validity we place in a thought and thoughts about ourselves. These are like the self-talk thoughts, like when you make a mistake, you know, what's the first thing that you say to yourself? Like, it's okay, try it again. It's more, you messed up, you're an idiot, how come you keep failing? You always do that, and we have this whole history that we can start to add upon that. You never do anything right. Or if someone rejects us, we perceive we're being rejected, oh, there's something really wrong with me. These are these deep, unquestioned beliefs that we hold as being true. And these deep beliefs are just a belief, just a set of thoughts. Essentially, it's no different than saying that the Earth is the center of the universe, that everything rotates around us. And the freedom of that is that when we see that clearly for ourselves, then a lot of our argument falls away. A lot of our suffering falls away in a very profound manner. So what is the correct premise around thought? So there's the relative truth of thought, you know, allows us to drive and do our jobs and relate to people, versus the absolute truth of it. That what do we know for that's really true in this moment? In our thoughts, you know, it depends on what our experience is. I can ring the bell, I could say something, and each one of us will have a slightly different interpretation of it. So it can't be thought, it can't be our interpretation of it. It can't be our idea of it. Even something as simple as close to us as our gender, we have the sense of being a female or being a male. But if we drop that level of thought, we close our eyes, what's the actual experience of being? Does it have a gender? Does it have an identity? Does it have a race? Does it have a sexual orientation? So even though there's an accuracy to it, there's not an absolute quality to this thought. to this sense of belief in who we take ourselves to be. So I always remember that there's a difference between thoughts and the actual experience, the actual reality of something. That thoughts can't fully describe something. They can point the direction, but they can't fully capture it. It brings this quality of mystery. So this is the first premise, that our thoughts are true, that our thoughts are accurate. And again, it's the relativeness, but not the absolute quality of it. So when you feel yourself tightening up around a thought, saying this is the right way to do things, then question that, bring that to light a bit. So the next one I'd like to speak about is that our this premise that our experience always needs our influence. That we always need to do something. We always need to be doing something with what's going on with our minds, with our breath, with our bodies. And much of our thinking really comes from this quality of unease, that something needs to be tweaked, needs to be adjusted. So in interviews, people often come forth, well, what do I do with this issue in my life, with this person I'm struggling with? What do I do with this hindrance? What do I do with this mind state or this difficult emotion, this situation? And really, as humans, we're very good at seeing what's wrong, what's the problem, what needs to be fixed. It's this orientation that we've developed. We really become expert judgers, expert perceivers of danger. And there's a historical part of this, that evolutionary, we live longer if we're able to see danger. But we carry this into our daily lives, into how we relate to ourselves, to others. And though it was very helpful to see danger, to avoid being eaten by the tiger, and at times it's important to see when there's a danger in our life, but it becomes this orientation. It can be very, you know, this paranoia, this sense of fear, but it can also be just this sense of unrest, that something needs to be changed with our experience. I mean, just now as you're sitting there, notice, are you able to be completely at ease in that chair or on the cushion? You know, or is there a sense of I have to kind of adjust it a little bit? So this can become more and more subtle. Even the sense of watching, of knowing that something is here, is still that quality of trying to influence our experience. So do we need to influence all the time? And this goes back to this relative truth versus the absolute truth of it. What about this breath? What about this body? Does this really need our influence in this very moment, in this very instant? This emotion, this other person. So often people ask, you know, have a basic question of what do I do with my experience? How do I deal with this difficulty? And ultimately the answer is to do absolutely nothing with it. That's one of the hardest things for us to do, is to relinquish our need to control, to change our circumstances. But just have this, for this moment, this complete opening to it. It's not disallowing, you know, planning ahead, planning for the future, you know, making our lives more comfortable. We're talking really about this moment by moment unease with experience. And one of the primary ways that we influence our experience is through thought, through thinking about it. And really this thinking becomes our basic orientation toward life, is through thought, the basic way we try to influence our lives and our experience. There's a quality of judging. You know, was that a good meditation or a bad meditation? You know, is that a good experience, a bad experience, a good talk or a bad talk, good weather or bad weather? There's also the quality of labeling, the sense of, I know what this is. And this happens so quickly, this sense of perception, of identifying. You know, Rodney was sharing this neurological study that talked about the same pathway of memory is the same pathway of perception, that they were wired to actually see and name at the same time, in the same wires. But yet, as soon as we label something, as soon as we say, I know what this is, then there's a way that we cut ourselves off from it. When we don't know what something is, when we're not sure about it, that's when we're the most engaged with it. We're the most attentive, really seeing what is this person, this experience, this thing in front of me. And there's this intimacy that comes from that. as soon as we label it, okay, I know what this is, I know who this person is, then we're suddenly cut off. We're relating to them through our label, through our memory, through our experience, versus the actual reality of this person. And so this is one of the primary jobs of the sense of self, is to label, to identify, to try to influence our experience. And that's why it's often so disconcerting when we start to relax that sense of self, because it means relaxing that sense of influence, that sense of having to control. And it becomes very tricky, this need to control, because the sense of self loves to have a job, loves to have a task. Oh, I need to not control, I need to not influence. I'm going to work hard at not influencing my experience. So, or I'm going to work hard at not being a person, not being a sense of self. I need to get rid of this sense of self. So it adopts this strategy, it co-opts it. And here's an analogy that I was using in the post-beginning class. That usually we go through life, imagine that you're a boat on the ocean. Okay, so we're steering it around, we're trying to do our jobs, and we're trying to navigate the icebergs and other boats, and some boats we try to hook up with, and other boats we try to avoid. And we have a sense of direction, that we're piloting this boat. And there's a sense, that's a sense of me going through life. So when we hear the Dharma, we hear this sense of releasing our influence, releasing our need to control life. Okay, then I'm going to start to pilot that direction, the boat in the direction of non-influence, of non-control. You know, sometimes we can have some success with that. It's northeast is the direction to go for non-control. But there's still a sense of me doing it. Now, the Dharma asks a very different perspective. It asks us to relinquish being the boat, being the pilot of that boat, and instead become the sea, to rejoin the sea, to rejoin the ocean that holds that boat and holds all other boats, holds these icebergs and these obstacles. If you get a sense of that, it's releasing the sense of control and identity and going into something much bigger, something much vaster that holds your will and your intention. So joining the sea means releasing this sense of self that needs to influence, releasing the urge, the need, the compulsion to influence, to control. And releasing the need to control makes the self unemployed. You know, it loses one of its major jobs. And when we do that, a sense of fear often arises, a sense of unrest. And like if my experience needs my control, needs my influence, and if I don't do it, something bad will happen. I need to know to identify. If I don't, what will happen? Well, what will happen if you release the control? I mean, sometimes it feels like it's when we used to believe the earth was flat. If you go too far down, you're going to fall off the edge. It's like if things go too far, then you're just going to fall away. And often the mind says, well, what about doing my job, doing my work? What about influencing those things? Those are all fine. It's just this moment-by-moment influence. Right now, sitting, listening, breathing, do you need to influence that so much? Do you need to influence it at all? And so the sense of fear that comes up is actually can be a very important guide to know that you're going the right direction. You know, initially, the fear can be fairly intense or can be just mild. But until we go through it, until we penetrate it and realize that it's actually this release of control also means the release of our struggling, the release of our suffering. It becomes the most safe place in the world. The most peaceful place in the world. But it's not going to be given up without a little bit of a fight, or sometimes quite a bit of a fight. When Galileo suddenly can't say his name, when he came up with this theory, you know, when he supported Copernicus, that the Earth is actually not the center of the universe, he wasn't met in open arms. They wouldn't say, oh, that's a great idea, let me think about that. He was actually met a lot of intense resistance. He was actually tried for heresy and found guilty of heresy. He was banned from ever talking about it. He spent the rest of his life under house arrest. because it really threatened not only this view, but also the church. The church had also established this view that the earth is the center of the universe. So too with our minds and with our senses of self, as we start to investigate these premises or challenge these premises, we have our own inquisition that comes in and says, no, that's not right, that's not correct. And it can be very, very strong, very gripping. But if you can learn to be quiet with that fear, be very still with it, then it starts to soften. We start to see below it. And these underlying premises start to lose their power. They stop being so gripping, so much controlling our life. And it allows us to open to a much deeper relationship to life, relationship to ourselves and to others. So the final premise I'd like to speak about. So we've talked about the premise that thoughts are true, that everything we think is right, is correct. We need to believe that. The premise that our experience needs our influence. And now let's look at the premise of that we are separate, that we're isolated, distinct beings, distinct people. We're disconnected and separate. And this is a worldview that we really believe in. This is our Earth is the center of the universe. Okay? And so again, there's a relative truth to it, right? There is a sense of John and Ed and Sally and Joan. There's these separate people that go through life. There's a relative thing. Christina Feldman was talking about the navigational self, the self that knows how to work and relate and talk and do things. It's not about getting rid of that part of the self. It's about this sense of being completely separate, being completely isolated. Not taking it as an absolute truth. So sometimes this sense of being separate can take an enhanced view, a narcissistic view of the self. That this is, I'm better than you, better than thou. And it's often, relative. It depends on who we're around. We sometimes judge people and we like to feel more important. Pay attention to me, look at me, give me my approval. But where is this quality of being better than, being more important, being special, where does that exist outside of thought, outside of our self-identity? So identity and our sense of who we are is really just a very refined and very entrenched thought, entrenched set of beliefs. We just finished the Olympics. So let's say you won the gold medal in some, to us, obscure sport. How many people know the Olympic medalist in curling? Right? For them, it's like, well, I'm at the top of my game, on top of the world. But they could be sitting right here and we would just think of them as a regular person. So there's a sense of being better than is very much depends upon if we buy into that thought, buy into that sense of belief. Then there's the diminished sense of self, diminished view. And this is often more of a coarse sense of who we take ourselves to be that often drives this sense of narcissism or trying to be important. This deeper core sense of lack, of not being good enough, being unlovable, not belonging, being unloved. This is the quality of being lonely, being separate from the world, separate from others. But again, does this exist outside of our thinking of it? Is it just a concept that we certainly have a lot of momentum, not to downplay how significant this can be, how strong it can be, but also not to forget that it is just a mistaken belief. A few years ago, I was doing some investigation when I was driving, looking at my patterns of restriction, my patterns of identification. So typically the way I do it is if I feel this sense of I'm insecure, I'm worried about this meeting I'm about to have, okay, tune into the felt sense of that. How does it feel in the body? What's the emotionality of it? What's the deeper thoughts that arise with that? What's the deeper logic? And got down to the sense of, okay, I'm there's something wrong with me. And the next thought was, and that's wrong. There's a sense of realizing that this thought, this belief was engendered a long time ago, but it was a mistake. It's not how things really are. And that brought a tremendous lightness to this pattern. to this deep self-belief. So the qualities of being separate by feeling better than or being less than, you know, kind of orienting ourselves in relationship to others. Now what about this sense of interconnection? You know, have you ever noticed that when someone is emotional, you hear something that's very touching, how quickly that emotion spreads? Like the whole room can feel that. And there's a sense of this interconnection of this humanness. Through our brains, we're separate. You know, the sense of thinking, we have this separateness. But through our hearts, we have this connection that transcends our differences. And another quality of this premise of separation, sometimes, especially in this kind of a community, in this community of Western Dharma people, especially the, you know, tend to be more Caucasian, there's a sense of liking okay, I'm going to just be more separate. I can really be quiet and introverted and not have to interact with people. But this quality of not being separate actually asks us to be fully involved in life, not to use the teachings, not to use the Dharma as a way to separate from life, to become more distant and more isolated, but actually asks us to be fully engaged in social issues, in relationships, to really look at people, to really show up, and to really connect. And this is this truth of interconnection, that we do influence people. The words we say, how we act, causes these ripples throughout the world. And going back to that analogy of the boat and the ocean. So the boat, we switch this perspective to being the ocean, not the boat. The ocean is still responsible for everything in it. Still responsible for the actions of that boat, the direction it goes, how it interacts. So as we summarize this talk, we have these three qualities, these three underlying premises. It's not an exhaustive list. It's just things that I felt wanting to talk about. The quality that our thoughts are true, that we have to believe in everything that we think. The quality that we have to influence our experience, that it needs our influence, that without our influence things will fall apart. And the quality that we are separate, the belief that we are distant and distinct from others, that we are this separate being. And so again, they all have this relative truth, but when we hold them as being absolute, that also is where our suffering is. So some hints on how to work with this. So the first one is learning to be very still with our experience. Because these premises are so close to us that it's like a program that downloads. Like when you turn on your computer, all these things get loaded on right from the beginning. It allows you to navigate your desktop. That's what happens with these premises. They get loaded on very quickly. So they have to be still, and they control how we interact, how we think, how we see things, how we actually perceive things. Like that bridge in France, that we see it as being a masculine or being a feminine. So as these being still with our experience allows us to start to slow down that quick cascade of experience, that quick cascade of knowing how things are. So being still, being quiet with our experience. So meditation really cultivates that quality. We're sitting still, our breath arises, emotionality arises, self-belief arises, and we're able to hold it with a different quality, a different spaciousness than we often can access. And being still enough, we start to get a sense of these assumptions, seeing how are we taking ourselves to be, how are we taking the world to be. And for myself, and watching students, surprise is a key element to these assumptions. It's like we suddenly realize, oh, I've seen life incorrectly. I've seen it through a wrong premise. And it may be something we've kind of known or kind of has some sense of it, but when we fully see it and fully understand it, then something shifts in us. This is what's called insight. So being still with our experience allows that to come forth, to be seen more directly. And the next one is to practice suspending our concept, suspending our idea formation. So the homework talks to this, that when we find ourselves having this worldview, see if you can suspend that. Okay, maybe, you know, okay, even right now, like, I am a male, I'm a female. Can you just suspend that for a moment and look at yourself in a different way? It's that why can't I say that? He looked at the sky and he said, well, this looks different. You know, maybe this belief is not correct. So suspending our perception of others, you know, of someone who's a different race, of a different gender, a different orientation than us, especially if you have this reactivity that comes up. Sometimes when I see someone of a different race, sometimes there's this reaction that just pops up. But instead of believing it, instead of enhancing it and going with it and adding more fuel to it, it's just, well, that where did that come from? That just is a product of the culture, product of my upbringing, but that has nothing to do with this person in front of me. Allowing myself to see through that. And then for ourselves, as we have these ideas of who we take ourselves to be, can we be willing to see through that? To see perhaps there's something much bigger, much broader. And part of this is looking at our investment in the truth, in this belief. In Galileo's time, the church really had a lot of investment. You know, so we too have these investments in these beliefs. So sometimes we have this belief of who I am, like, this is absolutely true. I don't care what he's saying. I really am a failure. You don't know what I've failed at. Okay, so what's the investment in being a failure? What's the investment in not being a whole person? And the final one is the surrendering to wholeness. So this is this going into the ocean, releasing our need to be separate, our need to be controlled, to influence, to have this belief and thought. And so it is a surrendering. There's just this release that often I feel like the Christian faith, this releasing into something much bigger. So we release into stillness. We release into that depth of the ocean. And realize that we're releasing into our deeper nature, to who we already are. And so, you know, as a teacher, there's a great delight in seeing someone see these underlying premises, to see, oh, I've taken life in a different way. The face lights up. The possibilities of life unburdened by this belief. You know, in my own practice and in your practice, there's this quality of the clouds parting. It's like the rainy day and suddenly there's the sun coming through. So we awaken to the truth at the moment. All right, if we could sit quietly for a few moments. And as we sit here, just notice what assumption is sitting with you. It could be very clear, like the sense of your name and that identity associated with it. It could be very subtle, like just the sense of being a person who's watching, a person who's seeing. And see if for just a moment you can suspend that belief. Be willing to question it. And not reforming a new belief, a different belief, but welcoming the silence, that stillness. Trusting that. Okay, thank you. So we have space for some comments or questions, both about this talk and also other questions or comments you might have about your practice or other issues. We'll be glad to explore that. Yes, Moffat. Okay. Let me see if I got the question. So, no, it's okay. So, I think the question is around we taking this sense of following our impulses or following what we naturally want to do. Is that going to be good for society? Because society has guidelines and rules and laws that help create safety for the masses. Now, if we just allow ourselves to follow those impulses, won't that cause harm, you know, overall? Or potential harm. Is that close enough, Moffat? All right, so it's a good question, and that's and often is what holds us is a sense of The way you ask the question, there's a sense of we're acting from our impulses, from our animalistic, you know, what's you know, what do we really want to do? Just follow your heart and let
yeah,
things
I'm
go.
Talking back with theoretical concepts, you're going kind of internal.
Yeah. So the other part that we missed is I missed in my reframing the question is this quiet coming from the stillness, coming from the quiet. So usually when we act out in harm, we're not coming from quiet. You know, we're not coming from stillness. And that's, I think that's the key part there. And it's, you know, we have, you know, in the Buddhist tradition, we have examples of teachers who have great insight and great depth of practice, and yet they commit a lot of sexual misconduct. Okay, so what happens there? You know, not having talked to any of these people, these men, for the most part, there's not a, I'm just guessing what happens, that there's a part that's not being fully seen. That they're still acting from this sense of deeper lack or the sense of not fully, there's something that's not fully seen. Okay. So, you know, in terms of ethics and in terms of how do we interact with people instead of coming from the stillness. So when we have stillness that's just arising, okay, we're just abiding in that stillness. There's also this quality of the heart being involved, the heart awakening with that. If the stillness doesn't have the heart, it's not really stillness. It's kind of going into a theory of emptiness, a theory of absoluteness that, you know, it's we're all the same, or our actions don't matter in the absolute. That's coming from this organ, from the brain, from the world of thought. So that since the stillness isn't fully developed or fully manifest in that person. So that, and it is an important thing to keep in mind, is that am I having this quality of I'm thinking about something, is the thought still directing it, or is there this deep heart quality to it? So if there's the heart quality, then ethical actions are just a natural byproduct. It's like, how can my heart reach out and harm someone? How can my heart not see the pain that will come from that? And there may be some momentary pleasure, you know, with myself and the other person, but seeing the echoes of pain, the heart can't look away from that. So, and I think it's a very important question is, as we try to come into the stillness, as this homework talks about, to rest in stillness, you know, that sees fully, but does not need to label or identify. Okay. and allow your engagement with life to emerge from that stillness. So it's also the stillness of the heart. And that's a very important distinction there. So it just seemed like we need to have some way to kind of cross-check. And that's why we have the precepts. You know, that's why the precepts are part of this tradition. So if you think, okay, I've really had this great attainment, I'm really, you know, enlightened, I know all these, you know, I really have it happening. But then I look at this, the precepts, okay, I can't steal, I can't harm sexually, I can't do this. It's like, and my actions point to that. The sincere person is going to go back and investigate, okay, where is that really coming from? So we never throw out the precepts. So that's the safe part of it. That it does create that. And I think it is an important, and that's why it's emphasized so much, it's an important part of this tradition and should be of any traditions, that this sense of ethics needs to hold our actions, that can't be let go of. Until the point that our actions just naturally come from a deep integration of the heart, of the deep stillness and heart are both one and the same. And then breaking the precepts just makes absolutely no sense. I think I stumbled through that okay? What else? Yes.
So I was thinking about your example of Copernicus and Galileo as how do we learn to like let go of these truths that
yes.
we have? And I was wondering, so was it that sort of Copernicus had the idea and so maybe Galileo was testing an idea that he'd heard? Because mm-hmm. I feel like some of what I'm trying to do with myself is here maybe you say, this is maybe you should question this truth that you hold dear.
Right.
And despite the fact that my heart is saying, get lost, to say, all right, fine, I'll test that. And that maybe that's the way in.
So the question is about the sense of not wanting to test, or just like, how do you actually test to see if something is true or not? And what's kind of the process of that? You know, how did Copernicus and Galileo do that? You know, how...
So it seemed to me like the lesson I would take from that is part of letting go of my truths is hearing them questioned and being willing to say, okay, what if I'm wrong? What if this, that is the truth?
Yeah, So part of like, what if I'm, for some reason I'm having trouble paraphrasing it, but let me see if I can answer it. Okay, so the question is how do we see if something is true or not? How, what's the process of working with that? So, you know, like a true scientist is willing to prove themselves wrong. You know that if we do really have a scientific study. You know, the proper thing isn't to try to prove something, is actually try to disprove something. Can I prove that gravity doesn't work? Can I prove that the Earth isn't flat? Can I prove that we're not the center? So that's part of that scientific rigor that perhaps was what the G-man, you know, part of what he did for that. But for ourselves personally, so we have this belief that comes up, okay, I am this way, I'm this kind of a person. And it seems like it's really true. So we can start to challenge that, not by trying to get rid of it and fight with it, but say, okay, if this is true, what's some of the payoff for that belief? Okay, how does that allow me to work in the world? Okay, so you start to keep it intact. You don't try to throw it away. So because of this belief, all these things start to make sense. Like for myself, like being inadequate or being something flawed deep inside was a core part of my self-belief. So I started to become quiet and still with it. And I start to notice how much I interpreted my environment and my life based on that, through that lens. So sometimes we start off really big, you know, seeing all these different actions, and we trace it down to the inside, we see this core belief. So we start to then see how, you know, like I hear the phone ringing and I expect it to be rejection. I expect the mic to make a big noise if I move wrong, you know. So, but it's all coming back to confirm this inner belief, right? So I start to see how solid it is, and then I just start to suspend it. Okay, I'm not going to get rid of it, but what is if that wasn't true? Is there another possibility there? And you just keep working with it. It takes a lot of patience to see it, because it is by nature unconscious, the buying into it, the belief in it. But once you start to see it, it's like at some point you may just see it completely different. Oh, this is the truth, or this is more true. And then this falls away. Does that help? Okay. All right, we probably have time for one more question. Over there? Yes.
Talk a little bit more about sitting with the fear.
Yes. So talking about sitting with the fear of letting go in particular.
Yeah.
So I was talking about not so much letting go, but letting go of our need to influence, our need to control. So for me, it was very helpful to be curious about it, to start to get us to be really curious of what is that shape of that need of control. So I first started by just saying, I'm just going to see how much I want to control life, how much I want to control my experience, my breath, my thought, my wife, my daughter, you know, all these things I want to control. And then it's like, this is kind of this trick that you do. It's kind of like a magician's trick that you shift your attention from the thing that you're trying to control to the actual, what does it feel like to want to control? So you kind of shift back a little bit. Okay, there's a sense of wanting to control. And then there's even another shift to seeing the person who wants to control, how I form a relationship to that needing, that desire to want to influence. So as I start to do that, then the fear starts to become more clear, become more manifest. And so we start to realize, well, if I don't control, then what is there to do? And so then the fear becomes more, you know, tangible, more felt. But kind of going through the logic of it, if you know what I mean by the, I want to control it, shifting to the feeling of controlling, shifting the sense of me wanting to control. Then I start to say, okay, if I didn't control, what would happen? And I start to feel that fear. And then the fear does take some resolve. It does take a sense of, okay, I'm going to sit in the middle of this. I'm going to kind of open to this. And so part of it is having trust, you know, trust that, you know, the teaching isn't in the right direction, that's a helpful way, that people say the fear is just a facade that you go through. You know, so there's that trusting that I can go through it. But really, it's the more you connect with that fear, you start to, you know, accommodate to it, you start to see it's not that bad, and you know, take a break, and you come back, and then eventually you start to look through that fear. And once you get through it a little bit, you see that there's this quiet beyond it. There's this deep stillness, this deep peace. And then you start to realize the fear comes up, there's something that's deeper underneath that. And, you know, if the fear becomes really intense, you know, open your eyes, just kind of orient, okay, is there really any danger in this moment? Okay, other than what my mind's saying. Okay, there's nothing harming me right in this second. There's nothing life-threatening. So it can help kind of talk yourself down, kind of take some deep breaths to kind of calm down the autonomic nervous system. And then just go back and touch that fear. Just do it gradually, a bit at a time, but be patient with it. You're welcome. All right. So thank you.